Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. In a world where competitive survival has become rarer, one UK retail institution has survived for 175 years, remained a trusted brand, has over 50,000 employees, 2,000 stores, 4,000 pharmacists, and has 85% of the UK's population living in within 10 minutes of a store. It's Boots, of course. Today, part of US Walgreens Boots Alliance, an entity with sales of over $140 billion and one of the largest purchasers of prescription drugs. We thought it timely to explore the future of retail, the big drivers of change, the overload of Western health systems, and how pharmacy dispensers may play a role, along with technology, the power of data, and what customers want. So not much. So, however, we have in front of us Seb James, CEO of Boots. Welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. I'm very flattered to be asked. I know that Money Maze has had to turn away over 700 people to its podcast, so I feel very privileged to be here.
Fantastic. Well, we're here in London. It's early May. It's a beautiful evening, dare I say that. And you're so busy that the only way I could get time on your diary was to persuade you to come and have a glass of wine at my home, and now you've said no to the wine.
Well, I need to stay sober for you.
So let's just jog back. You go from school to Magdalen College, Oxford.
Yes.
Our mutual friend Will Campion described you as a polymath and that you could have pursued any number of careers, yet you opted for management consultancy at Bain & Co. I don't know whether he was right about the polymath. We're going to find that out. But what options did you actually weigh up?
Yeah, so when I left university, there were two paths that were sort of, you know, the glamorous ones to pursue. One was in those days investment banking, the height of the Big Bang and all those kind of things. And the other one was consulting, which paid a lot less. But actually, I'm really pleased to have done it. It was a slightly more swashbuckling world in consulting in those days. And it's a great job for a young person coming out of university because you get to do a whole load of stuff. You're treated like a grown-up right away. And it's just a great place to start.
Right. Now, I note that after a period, you then decide to go for more education and go to study your MBA at INSEAD in 91. Now, very general, but today, how do you assess whether an MBA is going to help a person in their career?
So it does a couple of things, I think, an MBA. And an INSEAD MBA is great because it lasts only basically a year. And the benefit of it is if you want to change direction, it's a brilliant whitewash. So you go in from, I don't know, you started your career in engineering, you go to do an MBA and you can then move on to something completely different. And that's a lovely thing to be able to do. The other thing, and I think this was definitely true for me, is it's a way of getting a bit older constructively. There's no question that, you know, you go into consulting, you're thrown into a world of business, et cetera. And there's a moment where it's quite good to have a pause and say, look, I'm just going to mature for a year, learn a bit about things I've never done before and meet a whole load of new people. And INSEAD was great for that. And it's also super fun.
I actually did the advanced management program there, which is the cheat version back a long time ago. Now, you join Currys, and in fact, I think if I get it right, you join Dixon's Retail, and then you end up as CEO of Dixon's Carphone in 2014.
Yes.
Now, I have to say, a hand in the air, full disclosure, I own Currys shares, sadly bought at a higher average purchase price. We have had two bids, which I think have lapsed, so I don't think we're saying anything that we shouldn't. But as a shareholder, and we know we've talked a lot on the Money Maze podcast about undervalued UK companies, here is a company classically getting in the sights of, non-typical buyers. And I wondered as a shareholder whether you would think that the optimal outcome is for it to grow back into a valuation maybe that it used to have, or whether in fact the best outcome is simply to be absorbed and dealt with?
Well, I'm not going to answer your question for now. I'll come back to it if I may, but I think it's a good moment to reflect a little bit on what it is to be a retailer, and particularly an omnichannel retailer. I mean, the death of conventional retail or high street retail has been predicted now for, decades, ever since really Amazon began to move. And certainly when I was running Dixons, we thought about things in a slightly different way, which is we were saying, well, let's not try and be Amazon, but let's instead try and work out what our strengths are compared to Amazon. One thing was absolutely clear to us was that although customers loved coming into shops and they loved getting advice and experience, they were then quite happy to take that advice and experience and go to Amazon and buy the actual product. And I knew that we had a problem because I went into one of the stores and a lovely customer was chatting to one of our people, and then they literally bought the television online on their phone in front of which I thought was just rude. But what that highlighted to me is that you've got to work out what it is you're going to be. And our only question was, how do you pay for that service? And we found two sources of revenue that Amazon didn't have. One was customers wanted the product to be delivered to their house, installed, set up, etc. And the other one was that suppliers were desperate for a place to showcase their products and were prepared to pay us to do that. So as soon as you understand that dynamic, you can begin to build a sustainable long-term retail business. And it's exactly the same with Boots.
Right. So I want to go back to the question that I still think is valid, is that how does one think about value recognition?
On the whole, I think markets do a pretty good job of valuing assets, valuing management teams. And so it's very difficult to sort of second guess what a business is worth when a market's taken a view on. It's not always true, but my own feeling is that Dixon, or Currys, or as it's now called, that Currys probably has a way to go to rebuild itself in the hearts of the public, and therefore I think has some value opportunity before anything else happens.
Right, so in Jan 2018, you resign and you go to run Boots. And before we talk about retail, may I just ask you what you think was maybe the most important lesson you took from that experience that you were able to take with you?
Dixon's was my first CEO gig. And I remember when I was applying for it, when my predecessor told me he was leaving to go and run Apple Retail worldwide. And in fact, I'd gone in to resign to him to go and take a CEO job in a small fashion business. And I'd gone in and he said, well, look, just before you start, I need to tell you that I'm leaving and you're in the running to run this. So I zipped it and I got that job. And I remember the day I got it, because I was operations director before that, a job I absolutely adored. And I remember the day that John Allen, my chairman, rang me and said, there's good news, you've got the job. I sat for an hour with my head in my hands at the kitchen table thinking, oh my God, how do you actually think about leading a business of this scale? And what does the responsibility mean? And how does that affect your everyday life? And all of those questions were flooding through my mind. But it turns out it's a bit easier than it looks.
And was there one thing you took from it as a lesson that stayed with you?
So I think it was probably the most important thing was, and this is very trite and everybody will say this, was the quality of the people you have around you. And I was very lucky. We had some amazing people. And I took some of them with me to Boots. And I definitely think that having people around you that you like being with, that you think are super smart, is the difference between success and failure. And we built quite a nice culture at Dixon's, a culture of courtesy and respect. And I hope that that has been really carried through into Boots as well.
Got it. So as I said at the beginning, the hope today is we can tease out some of these critical things around the future of retail and the major forces. And I have read quite a bit of stuff around you and Boots and your history. And one of the quotations is that you have, so I'm going to quote back to you, is we live in a rapidly changing environment in which whole business models are dying, such as department stores, and also living at a time when at last the market's patience with non-profit making business to consumer online players has disappeared. So let's just unpack that a bit. What's going on with retail?
Well, you detect in that quote a frustration that I had for probably a decade that my online pure play competitors were able to simply invest in customer acquisition indefinitely and never had to make money as far as I could make out. And that shareholders were continuing to reward them with ever increasing share prices despite having business models that I thought were basically bust. That has changed. There's no question that we see that, partly in Amazon, but also in the Hut Group and other companies, which which where investors have said, finally, we no longer have patience for a jam tomorrow world, and we actually want you to deliver some jam today. And for high street omnichannel retailers like myself, that is a godsend, because at last we're playing on a level playing field and actually winning.
Are the department stores closures emblematic of something specific or a wider trend?
So I think the department stores is a special case because, and you see this globally, not everywhere. In Asia, department stores are still very successful and so on. But in across the Western developed world, the department store model is finding it very difficult to find a home in an internet world. Now, if you think about a department store, its job was to curate ranges of a wide range of products and to make decisions really on behalf of consumers to showcase that in an environment where people get service and so on. Now people are no longer prepared to pay for that service and they prefer the enormous range that's available online and from Amazon and others. And that has just taken out all of the profit-making top, the top 20% of that business. And that's why I think those models are no longer working.
Right. Well, I don't yet want to jump to Boots. So if we stay sort of, 500 feet, what is it that customers most want from a retail experience?
So I think that increasingly there are three kinds of retailer. And I think that's going to develop more and more as time goes by. There are general mass merchant online pure players, which Amazon is the most obvious example. And there are a few of these. And actually, there are some which are a bit specialized, like Shein and so on, who are taking big chunks of a particular market online. And they're doing a great job of, pilot high, sell it relatively cheap, wide range, and a faultless service as far as it goes. So that's sort of category one. Category two, obviously supermarkets and all of those things. The third category is the interesting one, which is specialists. And what I think we're observing now is that big and small, there is a third category of successful retailer, which is companies that are specializing, and therefore customers are getting a different experience in those stores because they're talking to people who really understand what they're talking about.
So can I ask you to maybe give me one or two examples? And also, at the same time, is there a geographical tilt that, the US is ahead of us, as it may have been in some instances?
So examples of specialists. Well, obviously, we think we're a specialist, but you see around the world in beauty, for example, Sephora, Douglas in Germany. These are places where people can come and have a particular experience together or with friends, which is totally on the beauty axis. And that's a decision that people are making to pass their leisure time. But there are others, there are watch specialists, fashion houses. These are places where people are coming in and getting a different kind of experience than they would get online. And they're really liking it and they're prepared to go out of their way to get that experience.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. When we talk about the competitive landscape, you have obviously highlighted, companies that sucked up capital and was down tomorrow.
Yeah.
But you also, and this is a quote from you, is that by using my key rule, which is in the nicest possible way, if your competitors are struggling, put the boot in. Okay. I'm afraid you need to explain that.
Yes,
because I know you seem like a nice bloke, but that doesn't actually seem that nice.
I think retailing is war. It's a game. I mean, it's a war game. And I think unless you set out to put the boot into your competition, you're never going to win. It's massively galvanizing to teams to have a competitor. We recently, Sephora has opened 3 stores in the UK and a big online presence. It has been incredibly galvanizing to our teams to say, well, what do we do to make sure that we have everything in our armory ready for when they open? In fact, in Westfield, we knew Sephora was opening. We had plenty of advance notice. We completely reconfigured the beauty halls, and our growth was bigger than the whole of their sales. And so competition can be a really, really good thing for your business, never mind their business, but you've got to take an aggressive stance. I remember Dixon's Best Buy, which was the US equivalent of Dixon's, came to the UK, and they gave us, for some reason, 2 years' notice. And I was in charge of what was called the Warm Welcome Committee. And the first store was in Lakeside in Thurrock. And they had this nice store. And they'd built this enormous pier with Best Buy written on it with letters visible from the moon. And the only weakness of their site was that it had 110 car parking spaces. So I went to my boss and I said, look, what I'd like to do is buy 110 old bangers, park them up in all the car parking spaces and then throw away the keys. And unfortunately, he didn't let me do it. So, but that is war. And that sort of warfare is good for everyone.
I can understand. And what I also recognise very quickly, Seb, is it's nice to know you and be a friend of yours. Now, I want to tilt to, it's the challenge of the Western civilizations, yeah, which is healthcare systems are, yes, under inexorable pressure. We can cut it anyway. I think that, you know, we're going to have a change of administration of political color in this country. I think it's Wes Streeting, who's the Labour, the shadow,
yes,
health secretary, who said we can't keep on throwing money at the NHS. It's a much bigger problem than the UK. Boots, of course, sits in an interesting place. It has this online doctor. People, you know, obviously we've got aging, we've got high prevalence of chronic disease. People go to Boots. Let's just talk a little bit about how you think this particular, you know, landscape shifts.
Yeah, it's hard to predict. So there are three phenomena which are causing the current discomfort within the NHS. The first one is, possibly four, but the first one is post-COVID, a significant uptick in demand. Secondly, we operate on a free at the point of use basis, which means that that demand appears. There's nothing to restrict it other than queuing, which is what we currently use. Thirdly, there's quite a significant workforce challenge, and the number of people that we can throw at this is relatively limited because it takes quite a long time to grow a doctor and even longer for a consultant. So faced with these exogenous external challenges, I think the NHS is coping astonishingly well. But your fundamental point doesn't change, which is we need to think differently about how we start delivering that healthcare. And the way we would think about it in a business is a bit different. And I think, you know, you would know too, if it was in your business, you would think about this slightly differently, which is to say, what are my problems? What problems am I trying to solve? And I don't know, you take an example, hip replacements, or whatever it is. What assets have I got to deploy against that? And you'd say, well, I've got pharmacies, I've got care homes, I've got hospitals, I've got GPs. And you would start beginning to try and match those assets with those problems. What we have in the UK is an incredibly siloed, and it's for historic reasons, incredibly siloed structure such that everybody in the healthcare system is throwing snails over each other's garden wall in order to try and protect their own position rather than thinking in the way a business would do, in a customer-centric way. And I do think there are alternatives.
Okay, and I think you said to me in an earlier exchange that you'd actually spent some time with Wes Streeting,
yes,
talking about this. What's the good outcome?
Well, I think that both parties have now, and both health administrations and the NHS, have now started to recognise that something's got to change. And I'm very encouraged by how patient-centric Pharmacy First is, for example, and I'm very encouraged by how patient-centric Wes Streeting has been on both sides of the political divide as they begin to say, we have an issue and we now need to start thinking about what could I use to improve that issue. And, you know, speaking as a pharmacy provider, it's really exciting for me and for our pharmacy teams to be starting to treat patients and to actually alleviate the problem rather than simply dispensing medication, which is an important function, but lesser.
And I said earlier on that I had obviously read, didn't know this before the research, that 85% of the UK's population live within 10 minutes of a store, and it is,
yes,
this very, very trusted, you know, brand. And yet you've got this very big online presence as well. And I just wonder, because you all are also closing some stores. I was in Salcombe last week and I went in to get a pair of glasses there. That sounds like me very old, but I've left my glasses in London. I went in there and this very nice store and these very nice people, and they were all rather sad because, you know, as part of a rationalisation, which, you know,
although come to. All of the, every single person was offered a job in another store, most of them took them up. So luckily they've got somewhere to go.
I understand that. But how are you trying to position Boots in the face of the potential, I guess, solutions it can offer?
Yeah. So, I mean, Pharmacy First is a really good example. You know, if you've got a throat infection or an ear infection, very painful conditions, and in England at the moment, there in many areas, there's a long wait to see a GP, particularly for non-urgent conditions like that. Now, you know, within a 10-minute drive of 85% of the British population, you can pop into a Boots without an appointment, talk to the pharmacist, be diagnosed, be prescribed, be given the drugs, and be on the mend within 20 minutes. That is a radical shift in the patient experience, firstly. And secondly, it's cheaper for the NHS. And thirdly, it releases a GP appointment for somebody who's got much more complex conditions, which really requires the GP's expertise. So I think it's a properly triple win. And we think there's lots more areas where we could get involved in helping people in communities. And they include things like cardiovascular disease, pain management, some mental health. There's whole areas which are currently taking up a lot of GP time and even secondary care time that I think community pharmacy could do brilliantly.
Embedded within that, of course, is technology.
Yeah.
And I'd like to break that down. Part of it is the data component of your business and your cards, but I'm going to come back, pause. Large language models, AI, lots of excitement. But what does it practically mean for you?
Yeah, so we'll unpack that into a few bits. So data, I think until fairly recently, we had a lot of data, but we really didn't know what to do with it. It was just sort of sat there. The Advantage Card program has been going for 25 years now, 26 years now. And over that time, we now have 75% of British women are active users of our card. So we have an incredible wealth of behavioural data on how particularly British women buy today, how they bought in the past, how that evolves through time, how people think about themselves. You know, I remember talking to somebody who said, well, we know what colour somebody's hair is and we know what colour they wish it was. And, you know, these are quite interesting things that will enable us to actually hopefully make people's lives better. And we've now started, particularly using our app, started really thinking about the person as a person rather than as a cohort or a segment or whatever it is. And that, I think, is the way all modern retail is going to go. It's all going to be about who are you and how can I suggest to you things that we think will make you a happier person or more closely aligned to what you're trying to achieve. And so that's the sort of the first thing. Large language models is much more blurred. It's much less clear how that's going to impact retail. You know, some people believe that websites will not look the same in 5 years' time. They'll just be dialogue boxes. You'll put in your question in random form. You'll have a conversation with effectively your digital assistant, and then a whole bunch of products will be suggested to you. I think that's probably a bit fanciful, but we launched, among the first in the world, we launched a chatbot, an AI-powered, large language model-powered assistant on our website. And you can ask it anything you want. You can say, I have a headache. You can say, how can I find out the right shade of lipstick for me? All of these questions it will answer in a really intelligent way, knowing our supply chain, knowing our product set. And you can say, you know, where is my order? That is definitely coming.
Two other retail comments. I noted, not that he's been a guest, Simon Robertson, CEO of Sainsbury's, said brands could benefit from a much higher ROI. Now, you have other brands and you have your own brands. Just take me into the world of brands.
Well, Florence Boot in the 30s went to Paris and she was very interested in democratizing cosmetics and beauty products in the same way that her father had democratized healthcare. And she did things like she would buy soaps and she would bring them, which were in France, they were sort of this size, you know, size of a brick, and she'd cut them into smaller pieces and wrap them up, and then she would sell them much more cheaply. And that became a range of cosmetics that a working woman could wear 7 days a week, hence number seven. And that brand has now been going for, well, nearly 100 years, delivering exceedingly good quality, but trying to do that at a price which is, you know, which is reasonable. And there are lots of, I won't bore you with the product set because I could go on all day, but there's some very, very interesting scientific developments that have gone into our skincare ranges, for example, that are available at a fraction of the price they come from the big brands.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. And how do we think about that own brands versus sort of the glamour brands, particularly since the premium products have had an inflation attached to them, but that doesn't match their cost increases?
Yes. So we because we're manufacturers, we know what's happened to costs. And we have had a few moments where we've talked to some of the brands about whether the cost increases that they're suggesting are appropriate. But my own view is that our job as a shopkeeper is not to dictate to customers what it is they should buy. Our job as a shopkeeper is to have the products which are hot on the shelf right now, which people want, to sell them at a reasonable price with great advice. That's the job of a retailer. And I think we do it quite well. Own brand has a role to play. You know, there will be a cohort of customers who would like to buy very similarly conceived products at a significantly cheaper price, and own brand fills that niche beautifully. At Boots, we also have some very sophisticated, you know, pieces of science that we sell under our own brand. So, I don't know, Dual Defense, which is the best cold defense and remedy, is a Boots own brand product. It was developed by our scientists. So there are functions for own brand. But I think that anybody who says, well, we're only going to have own brand, is missing the point, particularly in fun categories like beauty, where people want brands, they want to see it on TikTok, and they want to try it and have fun with it. And it's a bit of both.
My children always have colds. What's that product called again?
Dual Defense.
Dual Defense.
Yes, Dual Defense. You'll never have a cold again.
Okay. I'm going to go and buy some. I'm going to. That's going to be their, that's going to be their Christmas and birthday presents. Now, two different questions. And one, a while back, we had Martin Walters, who is CEO of Victoria's Secret, former guest, et cetera. He said, Boots is an incredible legacy British company. What impact has Walgreens' business had on the company's culture and values?
So I think rather little. In fact, the culture and values are locked in. And in fact, it was one of the things that I found a little frustrating when I arrived, was that it was incredibly difficult to engender a sense of more risk-taking and more entrepreneurial spirit within the company, because we'd done things for so long in certain ways. I think that Walgreens has been a really good owner of Boots. They've invested, continue to invest very heavily in the company, and they've more or less let it get on with the job it had to do. And certainly I found that they've been incredibly supportive in helping with the changes that I've wanted to put through and over the last few years. So I don't think that's been a big issue one way or the other. I mean, I think, you know, when KKR originally bought it many years ago, some of the more excessive, you know, traits of 1970s management, like the £3 million wine cellar and so on, were all sold. And probably that's a pretty good thing.
So that's very, very timely, because as I read this, and, you know, I've been around for a little bit, thought I knew reasonable amount about UK corporate history. In fact, Boots was the only company, is the only FTSE 100 company to be bid for by private equity. At least that was what my data showed.
Right.
You might correct me, you know, but that's
I think it has happened before, but it's rare.
Okay. And the other bidder was Guy Hans.
Yeah.
Now, Guy Hans was a guest on the show, and we asked him, and he said, this was his question: when we looked at buying Boots, our strategy was to close down general retail and concentrate on health and beauty with the intention of developing prescribing medical centres. How similar in terms of our strategy is the Boots of today?
It is eerily similar. It is eerily similar. I mean, you know, it's a multi-stage process, right? You it's not something you can do very easily with a brand like Boots at private equity speed. But we certainly, our drift has been towards health and beauty. We have taken out a lot of what I would call ancillary products. And, you know, I'm not sure it's our job to be selling photo frames and that kind of thing. I think increasingly people are coming to Boots for an extraordinary beauty range. And increasingly they will come to Boots for their prescribing medical centres.
I've got it. Which, of course, begs the question is, with a Boots, as in, where does it go? I think Tim Wentworth is the CEO of Walgreens.
Yes.
He's said that they are evaluating all strategic options about the future of Boots, because does it go independent? Does it list? Does it get bought by somebody else? I'm sure you're highly restricted in what you can say. But you know, how do you think about, you know, where Boots sits?
Yeah, so I don't think anyone's made any decisions, which is why, even if I could say, I don't know. But I think, generally speaking, the view is that, I think Tim is quite rightly asking the question, two questions. One is, what is the value of having Boots within WBA? Question one. Question two, is WBA the best owner for Boots? And I don't know where they'll come out on that. But we have a lot of independence to run our business as we want to now. And I loved being in a public market environment. And I think public markets can be really, really good for companies. But I don't know what the future holds. And I think either way, you know, our job is to try and do the very best to drive value in the business.
Okay, well, the release of our episode this week is with David Schwimmer, the CEO of the London Stock Exchange Group. And we were talking about the delisting, which it actually turns out the delisting phenomenon in the UK is pretty much in line with what's going on in the US. So there's right. just a relentlessly bad narrative about the UK, some of which really frustrates me and is inaccurate.
Yes.
But I would say nothing wrong with Boots being relisted in the UK as a 175-year-old retailer. Now, your philosophy on running...
I couldn't possibly comment.
Your philosophy on running a business. I found myself at the weekend, this is really a sad indictment of where I've moved, reading the Grocer magazine article of March of last year, and you were featured in there, which puts us in a really enviable camp on your 7 points or philosophies on running a business.
I can't for the life of me remember what they were, Sam.
They were things like trying to focus on a few things and have daily meetings. No, right. But you know, you've been at the helm of two big businesses and important businesses, you know. If you were to reduce your philosophy running a business, what would be the one or two things?
So I often ask myself an existential question, which is, does a CEO make a blind bit of difference? And I was particularly drawn to this question as I was every year we do a dinner for the lovely men and women who've been in Boots for 50 years and still work there. We do a dinner for them, et cetera, et cetera. And I was talking to a very nice woman who'd been there for 50 years. And I said, you must have seen a lot of CEOs over the years. She went, to be honest, I can't remember any of them. And so it was brought home to me in absolute stark clarity that, you know, we are dust to most of the people who are, you know, who are making the business happen every day that goes by. I think, therefore, a level of humility is incredibly important. You've got to see yourself in that context. You are a steward of this thing for a period of time. If you are very lucky, you can have one or two good ideas, you can bring together a really good team, and you can leave the company feeling proud of what you've achieved. And I am very proud of what we've been able to do together to make Boots a company back in growth, you know, beginning to get, you know, gaining market share now for 12 consecutive quarters. These are things that didn't look very easy 6 years ago and are now happening. And that's a lovely thing to be able to do.
So we've looked at all these aspects that fall under the retail umbrella. And that, of course, brings us almost to the market square and from the market square to the high street.
Yeah.
And lots of different, our office is just off Oxford Street, which is going through a renovation. High streets are either, you know, never coming back or they're being repurposed or they're actually, it's not quite as simple. Tell us about the high street.
Yeah, it is complicated. And, you know, what has happened, a lot of national chains have closed down. A lot of high streets are looking really sad. And I went to Hemel Hempstead High Street the other day, looks really sad. And there are up and down the country, lots and lots of high streets, everything boarded up. And that creates a proper community vacuum. And we saw that in the United States, in towns like Detroit and other places where the center of the town dies and everything moves out of town. And suddenly you've got real problem of crime and fear in the center of your towns. And, you know, our towns are too important for that to happen. Now, I'm actually quite optimistic because the issue has been one of property, and property costs don't go down very quickly, even when a high street dies. Landlords continue to want to appear to charge a higher rent in order not to be in a debt deficit of any sort. And that takes 20 years, geological time, to work its way through. But if you take a high street like Deal in Kent, which is near where I live, that high street was a bit of a dump for 10, 15, 20 years, and is now regenerating as landlords ask for reasonable rents, as the local authority asks for reasonable rates, and small businesses are springing up, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, all coming back, really fun boutiques, and the high street is beginning to come alive again. And the question to my mind is, how do we make that happen much more quickly in other high streets up and down the country? And it's not easy to do.
But you're saying that the push factors are landlords having to be more realistic and local authorities also having to say the rate levels need to be variable
or appropriate, etc. So the real issue is that the amount of trade has gone down, and therefore you need to pay less rent. I mean, less property costs. As soon as that happens, a town like a flower, a town just regrows. But often that can be a very, very long period of time during which your town dies, people move out, and you end up with a proper community issue which needs resolving.
So we live in Western economies. The US is a little bit higher, but UK consumption as a percentage of GDP is high 60s. The US might be, you know, touching 70s. You know, consumption is what many people, you know, live to do. Is anything changing ultimately in what they want?
The way people are discovering products is changing completely. So it used to be, certainly in beauty, that a mother would teach her daughter, you know, the product she uses. That's how that cycle would begin. And people were very loyal to brands. People were very loyal generally. They were loyal to shops. That's all gone. Now you have daughters teaching their mothers the latest brands on TikTok. You have a completely different dynamic around choice and recommendation. The most trusted are often influencers that they see on social media. And that creates a completely new dynamic that we all have to respond to or die.
Rapid fire questions. Who, if you've had one, has been a critical mentor in your life and why did they help?
So I'm going to call out Archie Norman. So Archie has been certainly critical and very often a mentor. He is properly no nonsense and he's been really a really good friend and advisor over the years. So I'm very grateful to him.
Fantastic. And doing, it appears to be, a really good job at M&S.
Indeed.
Talk about a brand. I am a shareholder of M&S. I'm very happy to see what appears to be a rehabilitation going on. Boards.
Yeah.
What do you think makes for a really good board?
So a board is a symbiotic relationship between a chief executive and a finance director and the board. What makes a really good board is when that relationship works well. There are two schools of thought, I think, among CEOs and their boards. One is the CEO, and I've lived with both, by the way. One is the CEO who regards the board as a necessary evil and slightly rolls their eyes and does the board meeting as best they can and so on. I'm not talking about the toxic boards, but just, you know, the ones where the board is an inconvenience. The second category is, I think, CEOs who say, the board is an expensive group of extremely experienced people. I may as well get the value out of them. And as soon as that relationship begins to form itself, then naturally the symbiosis works and the magic happens. And I think that's the biggest defining feature.
So back in 2010, Michael Gove, who was the education secretary, gave you a role reviewing state school spending. You were, I think your title was advisor to the Department of Education. What did you learn? And you know, now I know you've got four children, so you've seen education, you know, up close and personal. What do we need to think about more in the education of the future?
So I had a very narrow brief, and my job was to try and work out how money could best be spent in building and refurbishing schools, particularly building schools. And it was, what I learned was that incredibly committed and clever people at the department were not operating a process that was going to come out with the best outcomes. And it was fascinating to me to sit and work through processes with those teams. In fact, there was a team, and we were drawing it out on the wall, you know, as people did in those days, drawing it out on the wall, and we discovered a team who did a piece of analysis, and that piece of analysis didn't go anywhere. So there was a terrible realization in the room as we all sitting around discussing what everyone did, that those people suddenly realized that their work didn't go anywhere. And I think that untangling that and making that cleaner is something that probably applies to every business, certainly every government department, and is a real source of value. And by the way, a happy working life.
We had a question from David Bodmer, who is a friend of the show and a keen entrepreneur. And he said, you got these auto tills. He said, shoplifting is rife. Amazon Fresh are removing them. Are you keeping them or are you removing them?
No, we're keeping them. I mean, shoplifting is a bigger issue than that. I mean, shoplifting has more or less doubled since COVID. And it's not the auto tills that there's a measurable impact of that, but it's not the auto tills. There has unquestionably been a change in the social contract of some sort that happened since COVID. And it's now regarded as much more morally acceptable to steal from shops. And my problem is that it's not morally acceptable, not so much because of the stuff that gets stolen, though I really mind about that. It's more because of how incredibly unsettling it is for our staff. And I've been in stores where people have come in with crowbars, and I've been in stores where people have been shouting at staff and stealing from the store, and that is not okay. So the answer to your question is, we're going to keep the tills. People mostly like them, some don't. We also have, of course, man tills, but they allow us to have, in a big store, 60 tills that we could never otherwise have. So it's much quicker for most customers.
Got it. For you, Seb James, what's the unscaled peak or two that lie ahead?
So I would love to help anybody think about the healthcare challenge. I just think it's a really gnarly, knotty, difficult, important problem that I would love to get involved with in some way, shape, or form.
Okay, and that then leads us to, we have these, you know, a lot of young listeners from around the world. What advice would you give to a young person thinking about a career and having no fixed destination in mind? Retail, finance, yeah, Healthcare?
Well, I don't think anybody leaving university has a fixed destination. Well, very few people do. I know that some of the people who became prime minister said that they'd always wanted to be prime minister, etc. God bless them. But I think most of us slightly zoom about. I mean, it's right there in the word career, isn't it? I mean, you know, we slightly rock from one side to the other. And there's a lot of luck in a professional life. I think slightly enjoy the ride and go with the flow. Once you've been a shopkeeper, I think you can never do anything else. The immediacy of it. You put a product on the shelf, you open a store, you put a promotion out, and instantly the customer tells you whether they like it or not. I'm very addicted to that. But some people love building, you know, giant bridges that take 40 years to build. It's horses for courses.
Three final questions. A lot of discussion about executive pay, US v. UK, and we need to attract global talent. You sit there as part of a US-owned enterprise. How do you reflect on, you know, the getting it right such that we encourage good capitalism?
Perhaps slightly controversially, I do think that senior executives are paid a lot in this country, and I don't necessarily think you'd have much less good ones if they were paid less. But then I think that some very important and complicated public service jobs are not paid nearly enough. So I think it's really about making sure that you're doing what it takes to attract people who also have some other reason for doing some kind of work. I'm always a bit suspicious of people who are entirely coin-operated, you know, who only do a job for the money. I think that the best performing executives are the ones who also feel that they really love what they do and that they really feel the purpose of what they do. And that obviously they need to pay the bills, but they're not going to be motivated by, you know, gigantic sums of money.
Do CEOs, whether it's in the UK or around the world, compare notes enough?
Generally.
Yes.
Or about pay.
I moved on. Yes. Generally.
So there is a sort of a community, but I wouldn't say that I would sit down with other leaders of businesses or even retail businesses very often and say, you know, well, how are you dealing with this problem or that problem? It's like we do in some cases. So shoplifting, for example, is affecting all retailers. That is something we do sit together and there are forums for doing it. I think retailers are particularly nice people, but then I would say that, wouldn't I?
You have four children, as mentioned earlier. You got a big job. How do you relax?
I'm not very good at relaxing, to be honest. I'm not the, when we go on holiday, I'll get up early and go diving and then I'll come back and everyone's just waking up. So I'm not really in that camp. I just quite like the hamster wheel.
Right. And if you could have dinner with a business leader, any from anywhere in the world, who's most intrigued, impressed?
Well, I'm very interested in the psychology of entrepreneurship because I realized quite early in my career that I was a terrible entrepreneur. I tried and I was absolutely useless at it. I'd be very interested to meet some of the very few people who've started small companies and been able to grow them into global enterprises and still be there. I mean, there are lots of people who start companies, they sell them, you know, professional managers take over, et cetera. But we know all the names of those people who've gone from naught to big, the Elon Musks, the Zuckerbergs, I would love to sit down and just explore the psychology of those people because they are extraordinary, extraordinary people.
Well, we're hoping to get one of them to one of our Money Maze podcast dinners.
Well, that would be great.
So you, of course, will be the top of the guest list.
Excellent.
I'm going to stop there. I've been looking forward to this because on the Money Maze podcast, we've had lots of people from the investment world. We are having more people from the corporate world. You know, retailing is absolutely in front of all of us because it's what we do all the time. And yet we sort of see these shifts, but I don't think that we necessarily process them. So it's been really helpful. I normally, summarize, and I'm going to, you know, summarize. I mean, remarkable that you said 75% of British women use the Boots card, and that gives you data that you're now using. And the conclusion out of that is that retailers more generally are trying to match customer preferences with the evidence of their, you know, of their buying habits. Number two, that the importance of humility in a CEO is often forgotten, and you obviously are very, you know, you're very aware of that you are a steward of a company, and yet, of course, as we know from, you know, many CEOs, you can have a material impact, and that the high street is absolutely essential to all countries and you know, and cities, and their decline creates a vacuum, but that there are reasons to be a bit more optimistic, as there are some glints of hope around healthcare practices that might take strains off these overburdened health systems. So, Seb, thank you. Absolutely terrific to have you here. It's been a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.